When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Been going over again the aftermath, the last days of the baby boom and the future of power in America. It's a new book by Philip Bump. It's about the baby boom generation. He says this in his introduction. Members of the baby boom generation, that would be people starting on January 1st, 1946. In fact, in the United States, the woman who was born just after the stroke of midnight is considered the very first baby boomer or boomer baby. And then they kind of visit with her throughout the book, as the press did follow her throughout her life. I think she's still alive, right? Members of the baby boom generation see something now that they've never seen before. A group of people competing with them for power and cultural heft. Not only has the center of gravity been shifting, it's shifting to a group that did not look much like the baby boom. Often literally more diverse, more likely to come from an immigrant family, better educated, less religious, more liberal. America was visibly changing as it had visibly changed when the boomers were kids. But this time the changes were away from the boom, not toward it. And that is the source of a lot of the friction that we have in the world today. He said about 15 years ago, there began a cascade of events that sharpened this, the recession, Barack Obama's election. White Christians, for the first time, were less than half of the country's population. Whites were seeing, as a percentage, their numbers go down overall. All of this, he said, fed into an energy that first broke into national politics with the selection of Sarah Palin as John McCain's running mate. It coalesced into the right-wing Tea Party movement. Donald Trump amplified themes and furies bouncing around in right-wing media. So much of what we live with or through or around these days is because of who the baby boom is and has been. Philip Bump joins us now, national columnist at the Washington Post. He also writes How to Read This Chart. It's a weekly newsletter. In fact, when you read his book, you'll look at it as much as read it, I would say. At least that's been my experience. Philip, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
And I suppose you don't mind that. I mean, some of these charts are the most intriguing and revealing things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the book has over 120 charts, I think. You know, the idea being that a lot of the information is conveyed. I mean, we, when we're talking about the baby boom, we're inherently talking about numbers, right? We're talking about scale. And so it turns out that a lot of the things that I wanted to tell were better represented just visually than trying to, you know, spend two pages of paragraphs articulating what I could do in one chart.
So what are you trying to say? Why did you pick up this as a topic, and what's your thesis here?
Fundamentally, I started looking at this because I was intrigued by the way that Americans treat generations. You know, we talk a lot about generations. We recognize a lot of generational tensions. And I sort of wanted to explore that. And what I discovered as I started to write the book is that baby boom really is exceptional. You know, and we don't really understand the scale to which that is true. The baby boom was massive. You know, in 1945, about 140 million people in the United States in total. Over the course of the next 19 years, we're another 76 million babies born. So this is, you know, we have essentially the half of the entire population of the country is under the age of 20 by the time the baby boom is over, you know, relative to 1945. It's a huge shift. And so what I discovered as I was researching the book is that so many of the things that we now see, so many of the tensions that are now present in the United States are a function of the United States having for decades had to accommodate and deal with the baby boom and the baby boomers not being in power.
And the baby boomers not being in power, is that what you said?
No, and they're being in power over that time, right? And so now what we're seeing in this moment is because the baby boomers were so big and really defined and shaped what America is in this moment, now for the first time, they're really seeing that power challenged by younger Americans, by millennials and Gen Z in particular, who there are a lot of as well. And so that's why in this moment, as boomers are retiring, as we have this huge surge in the number of older Americans, we're seeing all of these tensions emerge.
As you note in the book, in more than one instance, the phrase, okay, boomer, where that kind of surfaced in my world, maybe just in the last couple of years. It sort of faded in, I think, cultural context lately, but that idea, okay, boomer, you know, I'm done. I'm tired of you're looking down your nose at me. And by the way, I'm quicker and more nimble on the internet than you are. That's out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I think what's really misunderstood about OK Boomer, or rather something that I think really should be highlighted, is that one of the aspects about OK Boomer, which is so unusual, is that it is really young people having a conduit for speaking directly to an older generation and confronting an older generation. You know, when the boomers were young, when the boomers were teenagers and in their 20s, yes, they can make their voices heard very much so. You know, you could have a protest on the campus of UC Berkeley. You get picked up by the San Francisco Chronicle and so on and so forth. But they're gatekeepers. Now that's not the case. OK Boomer emerged on TikTok, where you could literally respond directly to someone's commentary and challenge them and say, OK Boomer, OK, your generation is different than mine and I don't like it. That by itself is revealing about the differences between the generations.
How do we describe boomers today?
Well, I mean, there's lots of different ways to do so. You know, one of the things that is very apparent about the boom is that it is not a monolith, that it, you know, comprises tens of millions of people. Obviously, there are Democrats and Republicans, there are white people and Hispanic people and black people. It is diverse in that sense, but it also is characteristically different than younger generations in some key ways. For example, it is much more densely white. It is more likely to be conservative in its politics than younger generations. Not necessarily overwhelmingly conservative. You know, it's voted for Barack Obama, the generation voted for Donald Trump in 2020, a fairly narrow margin. But there are other characteristics, too, that the baby boomers are less likely to have gone to college. They are less likely to identify as LGBTQ. There are all sorts of ways in which the boom is different in younger generations, even though it itself is not obviously monolithic.
So there's the tension point, right? I mean, so while they were not raised in a world where LGBTQ was even a set of letters, or the music has changed, or the technology has changed, they are loath, is that it, to adapt to the changing world around them?
I'm not sure it's necessarily loath to do so. It is certainly the case that there's been a scale of change that has been pretty dramatic, including just things like technology, right? But it's also the case that the baby boom has been used since birth to being the predominant focus of the United States. Yeah. When they were little kids, they were the key focus, teenagers, and now that's changing.
But it's interesting, too, because you mentioned a moment ago, you made me think of the baby boomers when they were in college, when they were younger, when they were in the military, whatever. But that was... That would have been what, the 1960s, right? These were the liberal young generation, which maybe that's inevitable with any generation, right? Over time, they get more conservative in their ways, huh?
Not necessarily, and this is really a key question, right? Because right now we see this young generation that is really, really, really democratic, and more so than past generations. It is, you know, younger people today are much more likely to vote Democratic at a rate higher than even the boomers when they were young. We don't really have a lot of social research going back that far. I mean, social research is less than a century old, so it's hard to say what, you know, long-term generational patterns are in terms of voting. So it's not necessarily the case. It is the case that the boom tended to vote more heavily Republican as it aged, and part of that was the Republican Party changing as well to accommodate what they wanted to see. But I also, it's not clear that moving forward, if we're thinking about what younger Americans are likely to do, the younger population is much more heavily non-white than the baby boom generation. And, you know, older black Americans, for example, who are heavily Democratic, or should we assume that this young generation will get more conservative, even if that's the watchmaker that we tend to, you know, consider the pattern? I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Philip Bump's on the line, Washington Post columnist. His book is The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. You know, I asked you a moment ago, Philip, I mean, so if we are changing, is that good, bad, or indifferent?
Well, I mean, obviously it depends on your perspective, right? You know, and even among baby boomers, there are differences in how people view the increasing diversity in the United States. There has been research done, though, research that was done several years ago now. But essentially what they did is they presented Americans with different ways of talking about demographic changes, you know, either saying, you know, everyone's sort of there are very few people who are just white and we're now starting to get a better recognition of what diversity looks like, you know, a message like that, as opposed to something like whites are going to be a minority in the country by 2045. And what happens is, depending on how you talk about it, you can talk about it in accurate ways, right? Depending on how you talk about it, the reaction you get is different. But what that research found is that white Republicans in particular heard the message, that latter message about whites becoming a minority, and reacted very negatively to it. And so one of the things that we see is this idea that America is becoming more diverse, which by itself deserves more nuance than we usually give to it. But that idea is something that white Republicans in particular are freaked out about, and provides an opportunity for politicians then to use rhetorically to gain power.
Yeah, I sure was thinking about Tucker Carlson as you were speaking and as I was reading your book. What do you have to say about the phenomenon of him? Was he then able to capitalize upon that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the Republican Party after 2012, when Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama, the Republican Party said, look, this is it. We're in a new era. We got to figure out how we appeal to people besides older white voters. Then what happened is in 2014, Black Lives Matter emerged, and there was a crisis at the border with immigration, and Donald Trump emerged, and he said, no, what we need to do is we need to fight back against BLM and you know, protect white values, in essence. You know, he said it quite that explicitly. Then Tucker Carlson came along. He started his show right after Donald Trump was elected president, and Tucker Carlson really reinforced those very explicitly, you know, talking about how immigrants are going to replace Americans and what a danger and a threat that was. So he, too, is trying to build power, trying to accrue an audience based on this rhetoric. You know, if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, millions of people watch Tucker Carlson tonight, but this is a nation of 330 million people, right? So it's relatively small, but it still is this potent force where people can build large audiences.
And you can't fight the tide, can you? I mean, if that's scary to you because that's different from your world experience, you know, maybe, you know, you come by that honestly. This is the way the world was. Now it's different. And so, yeah, it's going to be maybe a little challenging to you. But there's nothing you can do to change that, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, none of us have real power over broad demographic trends. But I do think it's important to recognize a couple of things. The first is that Americans are already much more diverse than people recognize. The census bureau made this fascinating change between the 2010 and 2020 censuses, in which they gave people, there's a space where you can write, you know, if you are white, you write white. And then if you want to add more context to it, you know, other, you know, flesh out who you are and what your background is. It used to be that if you wrote, for example, you know, I'm African and Caribbean and, you know, my family's from India and Lebanon, for example, that they would only take like the first 10 characters of that. So they might get like African, right? But now they take most of it, most of what you write in that slot. And so it adds a lot more complexity to how people identify their own race. And that led to this huge surge in the number of Americans who said they were white and some other race. And it wasn't because America had suddenly got more diverse. It was just because we did a better job of capturing who Americans already were. Then, as the book focuses on, there's also this question of, you know, this idea that that whites are going to be a minority by 2045 is really rooted in the idea that people will continue to identify as Hispanic. Polling and experience show that's not really the case, that these things evolve, and that in the same way that over time, you know, Italians and Eastern Europeans and other groups like that came to identify as white, it may be the case that a lot of those people who the Census Bureau assumes are going to continue to identify as Hispanic will instead identify as something else. And then that changes the demographic composition, too.
Boy, one just last thought about all of this. I mean, sure. Our preoccupation with the color of the skin of our fellow citizens. Boy, I wish we could get around that. I wish we could get away from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's look, there's a quote that I elevate in the book from the 1970s, which is essentially, you know, being white means not having to think about race. I'm a white person, and you know, I spend more time thinking about race in writing this book than I normally would for a variety of reasons, but it's true. That because of how American culture and society is built and organized, that white people don't have to focus on race as much, but other racial groups do, particularly Black Americans, for them it's very, very present. And so, yes, it's very easy. You know, one of the things we hear from Republicans, for example, is, look, what about MLK? What, you know, what about judging people by the content of their character? Yes, great idea, you know, in the abstract. But what we find is there's still a lot of judging based on skin color that affects people who aren't white, and therefore is something that deserves elevation and consideration by white people as well.
It's an interesting point that whites don't think about their race, and I've heard blacks say, I think about it every day. I think about it every single day, black people have said, and I've heard that, and I can't relate to that, but I'm glad you're talking about it in the aftermath, the last days of the baby boom, and the future of power in America. Philip Bump from The Washington Post. I've enjoyed the book and your conversation, Philip. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.